The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Okay, good evening, everybody. Thank you for coming. Grab some food, but feel free to get out without food. There's a sign-up sheet that's coming around. If you are on the sheet, if you've registered, you're on the sheet, so just make sure the information is correct. If you're not registered, please fill out the information. If you have friends who are Dean's Fellows who aren't here and who didn't register, let them know, because we need to know about them so we can make sure that they have the full borrowing privileges. There are also thumb drives up here that have some handouts that we put together that we thought might be useful for you guys. And this presentation, as well as the PowerPoint, will be available on the same link that you used to register, probably in the first part of next week. It's my goal to get us all out of here by 10 after 7 at the latest. Eywood, 10 after 7.
I will do my part.
Thank you. All right, so my name is Ripple Weisling. I am a reference librarian. Some of you may have met me before, some of you are a little familiar. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about some of the unusual things about being a Dean's Fellow that you may not know about. I also want to put in a pitch where if you are doing a project for anyone and you have any questions, please come talk to me, come talk to another librarian. We won't be at the reference desk this summer, but we will be available by phone, by email. You can contact us individually, and please don't hesitate to do so.
Come by our offices.
Yeah, it's kind of quiet up on the second floor.
We're lonely.
This is Kilani Clay, who is another reference librarian, and John Haywood, who is an international and foreign reference librarian, as well as a U.S. law librarian, and he'll be talking to you in a few minutes. One of the things to remember is, as a Dean's Fellow, you have different access and borrowing privileges than you do just as a student. You can borrow on behalf of your professor. I probably will say 12 times, but I cannot say enough. If you borrow a book from us, from Interlibrary Law, from anywhere, do it in your professor's name. You don't want to have an overdue book. It will prevent you from getting transcripts. It will prevent you from graduating, possibly. And with the professors, they don't care about whether the books come back because there's really nothing we can do with them. So make sure that you do it, everything in their hands. Setting summer access for Lexis, Westlaw, and Bloomberg. Lexis and Bloomberg, I think, just happen automatically. It just carries over. I know that Lexis will just carry over. Westlaw does not. It's a little cut off at the bottom here, but they have a link. You have to actually click on it and fill out their survey so that they are sure you are using it for acceptable purposes. Acceptable purposes for Westlaw embrace being Dean's Fellow or doing summer research or working on the journal, so that shouldn't be a problem. It does say school or unpaid work. By unpaid work, they don't mean that we pay you, so you don't have it, so you just still work with your professor. You do have enhanced copying and printing. This is a little complicated, and I'm not completely clear on it just because our printing works differently, but you definitely have enhanced copying and printing privileges. You will have printing allotments on your, or you should have printing allotments on your card by virtue of being a Dean's Fellow. If you don't, get in touch with me, and I will make sure that you do. And when you print, use the printing allotments, not your Eagle Bucks. They will reimburse printing allotments. They are a pain in the butt about reimbursing Eagle Bucks, so don't use those. Every time you do printing or copying for your professor, you have to fill out a reimbursement request. It's a little bit of pain in the neck, but unfortunately, that's the way it works. The form is online. Make sure you do it every time. Your professor will need to approve the request. If they don't do it in a timely fashion, bug them. We're actually cut off on the bottom here because we didn't want to interfere with food. But the last thing to remember is that there is not a copy card that the library or that anyone else gives you. It's just the allotments on your ID. This has changed in the relatively recent past, and so there may still be people telling you to get a copy card. Disregard that if you get the allotments on your ID. Borrowing books. Borrow in your professor's name, not your own. When you check out, make sure that you tell the circulation desk that you are checking it out on behalf of your professor. If you don't tell them, they won't know. So make sure to tell them that. make sure that they have the approval for you to do that. If you have registered by using the link on the website, I have your name and I will send that to circulation, and they will make sure that you get it, that you have the approval. If for whatever reason you are not registered, your professor will have to email them and let them know. Instructions for what to do are here. We give you information on keeping track of your accounts, so you know you have a look at your My Legal account. If for whatever reason you borrowed in your own name and not your professor's, you can see what you have there. Stay on top of that and transfer everything out of your name if it's for a professor as soon as possible. If you have questions on borrowing, on what you need to do, you can email circulation. Their email address is there, and they will help you out with any specifics. You can also borrow from the university library. Because we're members of the university, we all have full access to their library. Don't do it directly. It seems it'll be really tempting, especially if your professor's in a hurry, to just run up the hill and do it. You can borrow from them directly. You can also borrow from them on behalf of your professor if you fill out their proxy borrowing form. But I really don't recommend it. Use interlibrary loan, because if you borrow it directly from them, you are subject to their authority and their rules and their fine system. And so if it comes back late, especially if it's checked out to you and the professor won't give it back, it could cause a problem, and there's nothing we can do about it. If you've done it to us through interlibrary loan, we have more room to take care of problems and hopefully prevent them. Again, make sure that you are monitoring your account if you are borrowing from them against all of our advice, and just make sure that you know that you're on top of it, and so you know if something's late.
They will bill you.
Yes, they will. Yeah, they are not. We are really nice about fines and late fees, and they are not. So don't get involved in that. And I realized that I forgot to put on the mic. Nobody can hear you on the podcast.
I'm very sorry, podcast people.
He was probably picking you up anyway.
Probably.
Okay. I hate talking on the mic, but let's see how it goes. Okay, so interlibrary loan, if you haven't used it before, go create an account. It's available on the library services link from the library website. There's also a link on, there's a whole form about how instructions for interlibrary loan and how to use it. Create an account. Use WorldCat, which is available on the research tools page of the library. I'm going to show you a little more detail about this in a minute. That's the easiest way to do it. Don't try to use Aladdin. That's available. It's provided by the main campus. I think actually WorldCat is a lot easier and more efficient. So create an account, and then you can borrow. If you are borrowing for your professor, include their name in the notes field. Say that this book is borrowed for professor such and such, and include their email address. And again, that way we'll know who has the book, and so we'll know who to hound for it, not you guys. This is how you make an ILL request using WorldCat. This is our homepage for the library. You guys have all seen this before, but there's a research tools page. Then at the bottom, there's WorldCat. You click on it, you do your search for what you're looking for. The example I used here is Treasury of Great Russian Fairy Tales. So I knew a title. If you don't know a title, it's easiest to do if you have a title. You can also just go on and search. So if you're looking for books about a topic rather than a specific book, you can do that as well. Once you find your book, click on the title of the book, and it will tell you, there's a link it's a little hard to see here, but it says borrow from interlibrary loan. Once you click on it, you sign in, it already has all of the information that you need, so you don't have to type it into the form. Put it in, if it's for your professor, where it says wanted by, put in their information, and then you're good. Once you've made requests, you can track them here. You can look to see items that you have checked out. You can see if you get articles, you can also use this for articles. So if you're looking for articles for journals that we don't have, this is the easiest way to get them. You make the request, and it comes to you in a PDF, and you'll be able to print it out. If you have need additional information about borrowing or about interlibrary loan, if you go to the library services page, there's a link for circulation services. That tells you all of our services. It talks about hours, reserves, renewals, interlibrary loan. All of the information that you need is there. You can also contact circulation or just come to the desk and ask questions. It also links you to WorldCat for borrowing through interlibrary loan. This is the interlibrary loan policies and how to use it.
You will get notices if you borrow from us. It's important to stay on top of it, especially if you have stuff out in your own name. So just make sure that if you get email or phone call from the library, respond to it. Make sure that the email and the phone number that you're putting on the sheet are the ones that you actually check and use. You don't have to necessarily use your WCL email address if that's one that you don't check. Use whichever one you actually pay attention to. If you have any questions or any problems about it, contact circulation, contact me, contact John, contact Kilani. Reach out and talk to somebody. Do it early. It's much easier to head off a problem than it is to try to solve it. A couple of things that I want to make sure you guys know about, because we're not having someone from reference desk this summer. We're actually not doing chat reference now, but we need to turn that on our computers. And if you email reference or RecLive, that goes to all of us, and somebody will get it and get back to you. There's pretty much someone on duty from about 7:30 in the morning until about 8 o'clock, Monday through Friday. So reach out to us if you want to meet. We can do it then. We can also set up different times if those times don't work for you. This is the email. This is the chat reference page. You can also stop by and see us. I have everybody's email and office number on there, and I even remembered to put our new office number since we're now in the building.
I'm at 214.
Oh,
well, close enough. Okay, a couple of things that you just want to make sure that you know about. We have a whole bunch of stuff. If you're looking for books, you can use Encore or you can use Legal. We have a whole bunch of legal databases. There's a much bigger role out there than Lexis and Westlaw. And this is a time where you may actually really need to use them, because often doing research for a professor is very different from what you've done before. And so we have all of these resources. They are available either organized alphabetically or topically on our databases and websites A to Z or by topic pages. There are also a number of indexes. If you were doing research for law review articles, we recommend that you use indexes rather than just relying solely on Lexis and Westlaw. There's more stuff out there than is in Lexis and Westlaw, and this is a good finding tool and a way of making sure you're finding everything. So there's Legal Shack, there's Index of Legal Periodicals and Books. They're available from the Research Tools page. You also have access to everything that's available at the main library. So we have a pretty good selection of legal materials. We don't have social science, economics, business, etc., but they do, and we get to use all of their stuff. It's available to you from wherever you are, and there's no charge for it. So make sure you take advantage of those. The main library's link is american.edu/library, so it's quite simple. You have access to their whole catalog. A few things to know about: here's the Research Tools page, here are our database links, here's the catalog, this is a quick tour of our webpage. You're finding periodicals. Again, we have many indexes that we prefer that we suggest that you use. Between the indexes and Hine Online, you can pretty much get everything, even if it's not available in Lexis and Westlaw. I want to take the opportunity to say, as I always do, don't ever find yourself in a position of searching Hine Online. The search is getting better. It's better now than it was 4 or 5 years ago, but the search is terrible. So you're going to get like 5 results or 5,000 results. Use an index, find the information that you need before, and then just go to Hine and pull the article. Then, of course, there's Lexis and Westlaw. Make sure that you have updated your access for the summer. Some databases that you should know about, that some that I'm sure you're familiar with, a couple that may be new to you that I want to make sure that you have heard of at least. There's WorldCat, which I mentioned earlier. If you're doing interlibrary loan, if you're looking for books, that's the best place to look. There's also the Bloomberg BNA Library. You guys have used Bloomberg BNA Law in the first year. They also have a whole range of specific products available in different legal areas, particularly if you're doing research in an area that's heavily regulated, like tax or environmental. They have all sorts of services for staying abreast of developments there and for learning about the law there, and so don't forget about those. There's also CCH IntelliConnect.
again, which is very strong in arbitration and tax. And so if you're doing research in those fields, remember that there are things in addition to Lexis and Westlaw to take a look at. Bloomberg Law, you know about, is also really the place to go for docket research. If you're following a case, if you need pleadings, if you need something that's at an earlier stage in litigation than the final opinion, Bloomberg Law is the place to go for documents to get it. Some professors will direct you to PACER. This is really sort of replaced PACER in our estimate because it's got everything that's on PACER and then some. Sorry, this mic is driving me nuts. But so if someone says PACER, just mentally substitute Bloomberg Law and go and find information there. There's also ProQuest Legislative Insight, which everyone used at least a little bit in rhetoric, I think. That's the premier place to go if you're looking for legislative history, and lots of professors do legislative history research over the summer. So know about that. There's also Social Science Research Network and Digital Commons. Those are repositories for articles in all sorts of scholarly disciplines. It's not, particularly with SSRM, the search is not especially sophisticated, but there's a lot of information freely available there, articles in PDF, and papers that are available before they're formally published. So that's a good research resource to know about. There's also Supreme Court records and briefs if you're doing historical Supreme Court research. The downside is it stops in 1978. I wish they'd pick up and move forward because it's a great resource, but if you were looking for materials from older Supreme Court cases, that's a really good place to do it. Newspapers. We have reduced or free academic subscriptions for New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal. The details are included in the PowerPoint. When you look at it, the access is a little different, but you can get them for free or for dramatically reduced cost through your academic subscription. There is also a resource called ProQuest News and Newspapers at the main campus library. That's pretty much any newspaper in English going way back. And so that's good if you are doing either historical research or if you are looking for articles that are not in these publications. Also, don't forget Lexis and Westlaw. They have extensive newspaper databases. It's not PDF, but it's very easy to find. Accessing our databases. Most of the, I don't know if you guys are going to be here, probably you won't be on campus a whole lot for the summer because it will be freezing here and you probably have, like it is in this room, and you probably have more interesting places to be. But wherever you are, you can get into our databases. You've probably done this before, but I just wanted to remind you, make sure if you're looking for something that's in Hine Online or that's in one of the Bloomberg BNA databases or something, that you start with our website. If you just go to hineonline.com, you're not going to be able to get to it. If you start from the Law Library website, you will be asked to authenticate through our proxy server, and then you'll get full access. You can do the same thing with the main campus library, actually, which I meant to put on the slide, but I forgot. You just go to their website, and you do the same thing. So if you need articles that are in a database that they have there, go to american.edu/library, pick your database, and then search. For non-legal materials, as I mentioned, the main library is your friend. You have full access to everything. They have their catalog and their databases and their journals link. The Find Journals link is particularly useful, I think, which I will talk about in just a minute, but they have a whole bunch of stuff. Because they have a lot more programs than we do, they have a really rich group of resources, and you have full access to those, so don't forget to take advantage of them, especially if you're doing social science or business research. Find Journals is on their main page. If you are looking for an article in a journal that is not in Hine Online, the best way to figure out if you have a citation to an article, to figure out where to go and get it, check our catalog first, type in the name of the journal, that'll tell you if we have it and if so, where. If we don't, go over to the main library, especially if it's in a non-legal discipline. It's, you know, I get questions all the time, like, I'm looking for the Journal of the American Medical Association, but it's not in Hine Online, where do I find it? Well, it's not on Hine Online, because Hine is a legal database, so if it's not legal, jump over to the main campus. Just type in the name of the journal. The one I'm using in this is the Journal of Quantitative Criminology, and it tells you where they have it, and what databases it's in, and what years they have. The coverage can vary. Often things will be in three or four different places, depending on what year you need, so pay attention to that.
then just click on whichever one has the years that you need, and you just follow it down, and it will get you to the particular article. They also have a large collection of databases that you can just look for. It's databases A to Z. And then they also have built in a subject guide. So if you're not sure what databases are relevant for your subject, you can look here and it will suggest them. Remote access, again, works on the same principle that it does here. You go to their website, select your database, and they'll prompt you to log in. We're going to talk a little bit about research strategy, not too much, but just to sort of give you the basics. I think the most important thing is to understand what your professor is asking you for, and that's really easy to say, but it's often difficult to practice. Don't be afraid to ask questions. I think almost all of them, especially all the professors who work with these fellows, know that you guys don't have dozens of years of research experience, and so they'll patiently explain to you what they need. And just make sure that it's clear. Like, do they want you just to give them a quick answer and find them a couple of cases or articles? Or do they want you to do a full research project? You know, you don't want to spend a lot of time writing and carefully and exhaustively researching something if all they want is a 10-minute answer. So make sure you know what the scope is and what sort of product they want from you. Do they want you to actually write something down? Do they just want you to give them a list of cases and articles? Be organized. Organization is most of the work when you're doing research for somebody else. It's really important when you're doing your own research, but it's really, really, really important when you're doing it for somebody else. So do a research log. Like, at the minute you start your research, just keep track of what you do. John is going to talk in a few minutes about using Zotero and EndNote for this, but whatever format works for you, just keep track of what you've looked at. Make sure you get the full citation so that you can actually tell somebody where it is and you can find it again. There's nothing more frustrating than think, I read this great article, but I remember what journal, but I don't know when it was from. Keep track of the URLs for your online sources and make notes to yourself like how you found it. Sometimes it's obvious how you found it and how to go back and do it again. Sometimes it's not. And you're going to be passing the research on to somebody else, either to your professor, who may pick it up from there, or who may give it to someone else. So make sure that your pathway is clear. Don't reinvent the wheel. There's a lot of stuff that's been done already. There are treatises, there are articles, there are practice aids, there are all sorts of things that will help you get started on your research and that will give you a lot of information. Sometimes they'll completely answer the question you're looking for. So make sure that you start there. Don't jump in necessarily with law review articles or case law. Look to get an overview of the law. Look to see if someone else has done some work on this that you can use. We have all sorts of treatises, books, and articles in all kinds of formats, and then you can use those for the explanation. They will also cite you to the primary sources. Make sure that you make use of all of the tools that you have available to you. Shepherd's and Keysight are great for knowing someone's good law, but they're also even better for using it to further your research. So you find stuff that cites this case. You find additional cases that may be relevant to you. Make sure that you use key numbers and headnotes, especially if you're doing case law research. When you find something that seems like it's on point, then you can run that through your jurisdiction or any jurisdiction that you need, and that will help you find cases very quickly. And there are alerting and updating services. Make sure you use them. Pretty much everything has an update. Make sure that you set those up so that that will automate some of the work for you in terms of doing your research. Interlibrary loan, we can get you just about anything from just about anywhere, but it might take time. If something's, at Georgetown, you can probably get it in 2 days. If something's in Australia, it's going to take longer. So start early. Make sure that you look early on for books and that you get the process started. Sometimes we can expedite, sometimes we can't. So timing is really important. And use interlibrary loan rather than going directly to the main campus or to other libraries to check out. For most, you can't, but it's always in your interest to use ILL. And again, don't check stuff out to yourself. Check it out to your professor. A little bit about using web sources. Don't be afraid of things like Google and Wikipedia. They can actually be really helpful, especially if you're starting early and you don't know what anything about this area of law.
You can get a really good sort of working understanding of something from Google or Wikipedia in about 10 minutes, but don't stop there. Especially if you're using Wikipedia, don't ever cite it. It's just kind of a dirty little secret that everybody uses it, but nobody ever admits it. Look at the sources that it refers you to. It will have most recent decent entries will have citations and footnotes. Look at those. So make sure that you use that as a starting point, not as an end point. Use more than one search engine if you can. We all have a favorite, but so the results that you get are different often depending on what search engine you use. So, you know, run it through Google and then Yahoo or Safari or something else and see what happens. Use Google Scholar. That's a great way of finding scholarly articles and that you will have quick access to. So when you're doing, you don't just rely on what's on the open web. If you use Scholar, you limit yourself to scholarly materials. Evaluate carefully, though, when you're looking at web stuff. There's a lot of good information out there, and there's also a lot of crap out there. So just pay attention. And I think make sure you understand the provenance of whatever source you find. You know, who publishes it? Where do they get their money? Who are they affiliated with? What do they actually know about the topic? Just ask yourself those questions, then also pay attention, you know, what's the editorial process? Is there any, or is this just something that whoever feels like it posts whatever they have to say? Is there a political, social, or financial agenda behind the information that you're getting? We're all lawyers, we all know how you skin information. And the information that's been spun isn't necessarily wrong, but you just have to know that it's been spun and account for that. Also pay attention to updating. Is this, you know, it's sometimes hard to tell with a web source when it would actually put up, and so you want to make sure that you do that, especially with something current, because if you're looking at something that's in the process of changing, if something's even as old as a year or two, it could be completely misleading. So just make sure that you have that information before you rely on it. Updating. Update early and often. It's just good research, and it will help you make sure that you're not missing anything. Check the source, check the dates, and be updating on everything, even if it's electronic. Don't assume just because it's electronic, it's up to date. Use Shepherds and Key Sites, obviously. They will also help you flag legislative and regulatory developments that are important to know about. Take advantage of the updating services. And then I suggest, too, that if you're doing a longer-term project, go back and update your search at least once, sort of actually go through it again. We talk about research being iterative, and so what you know on day 2 and what you know on day 12 will be very different. And so they may help you, you may be able to construct a much better search on day 12 than you set up with and did an alert out on day 2. So you want to make sure that you're actually refining your search if you're running an automatic update. How do I know when I'm done? That's the most important thing. Probably the deadline is really what drives knowing when you're done. If you're out of time, you're done, but whatever you managed to get by that point. But make sure that you understood the question you started out with and that you answered it, whether it's yes, no, maybe, I don't know, there's not enough information to tell. Just make sure that there is an answer. Make sure you've documented and updated everything that you've used. If you've updated everything and you're not finding anything new, that's a pretty good indication that you're done. Are you seeing the same group of sources every time you try to do more research? That's also a really good indicator. So if you're coming up with the same 7 things, then you know chances are pretty good that you're done. If you still have questions, if you need additional resources, come and talk to us, contact us. If you're spending more than 10 minutes trying to find something and trying to figure out a search strategy, you're probably wasting your time and spinning your wheels. So consult with one of us, and we're happy to help you. And I will now turn it over to my colleague, Mr. Haywood.
Indeed. I know you love these. All righty. All right, can everybody hear me? Okay, good, good. That's always good. I'm going to walk out front because I hate being
late.
Yeah, now they can't hear me. Okay, I'm John Haywood. I'm going to be talking to you tonight about international foreign law and also about a tool that I like to use called Zotero and another tool called EndNote, which will help you manage your resources, manage your research. Let's start with some definitions. But first of all, are any of you working for professors that are doing international or foreign law? Okay, a few. Good. How many of you have had international law, either in law school or otherwise? Okay. Some of this might be a little bit repetitive, but we'll try not to. We'll try to make it good. A few definitions. Municipal law. Municipal law is not city law. Municipal law is the law of a nation state. American law is American municipal law. You need to know that because in a lot of the resources you're going to use, they refer to it that way. Foreign law is another nation's domestic law, another nation's municipal law that's not yours. So when we talk about foreign law, that's what we mean. We're studying another country. Comparative law is studying, comparing more than one foreign country or foreign and domestic country, domestic law. International law isn't foreign law, isn't comparative law. It's looking at the rules that govern the relations between states. It's a very different set of materials. Okay, we're going to start with foreign and comparative law. It's not as easy as you think it will be. Each of the 195 nation states in the world has a distinct and complex legal system. They all take a long time to learn, just like it takes a long time to learn our legal system. You're not going to be able to be a French lawyer in 30 minutes. It's just not going to happen. So you have to rely on other tools that will help you. This is probably the most important thing about foreign law. Most countries do not legislate or adjudicate in English. They do it in their native languages. That sounds pretty obvious. The number of people I've had come to me and said, well, I need this Turkish family law in English, an official copy. Not going to happen. They don't do it, just like we don't legislate in Turkish. You're going to need to look for translations. Google Translate can sort of be your friend. It can at least help you maneuver around databases. If you really do need something translated, you'll need to either use one of the services that cost a fair amount of money. There are several of them downtown. We can point you toward them. I think you're going to use it in court, for example. You would need to do that. If you're just doing it for your own research or for a professor's research, the International Legal Studies program here has lawyers from all over the world. If it's only a couple of paragraphs, many of them will do it for a cup of coffee. We use them all the time for that. Okay, the first place to start when you're doing foreign law is the Foreign Law Guide, which is on our A to Z list, the databases A to Z that Ripple pointed out. This is what it looks like when you pop it open. Okay? It's graphic stuff up top that doesn't help. Scroll down, you get to a listing of countries. They're broken into four alphabetical groupings. We're going to pick the first ones on this, France as my example. You click on it, you scroll down to France, you get to the entry on France, right? Pretty simple. If you look right here, there's a bunch of things that it tells you. It gives you an introduction to the legal system, to the government, an introduction to the whole thing, to the government, the legal system, research guidance, and citation notes. Those are all really, really useful. If you know nothing about the French legal system and you have to do research in it, it helps to have at least a little bit of an idea of how it works, what their system is. Is it a common law system? Is it a civil law system? We're in a common law system, or mostly a common law system. Judicial opinions are very important to us. France is a civil law country. Judicial opinions don't really matter. Judges don't make law in a civil law system. Judges interpret the law and apply facts to cases. When we look at when I'm teaching a class with foreign lawyers in it, it's always interesting because I show them something like the Bakke decision or Roe v. Wade, thick U.S. Supreme Court decision. Decisions in France and in the Netherlands and other civil law countries are 3 or 4 pages long. It's not the same thing. So they also don't have the tools that we have. They don't need the tools to find case law because it's not really law. It's just something they use to get some useful things out of it, but not the law itself. So they don't have case law systems like Westlaw. We do. What they use are primarily our codes. And one of the other things that's really nice about the Foreign Law Guide is that it gives you listings of the Official Gazette, any official compilations, session laws, which are just like our session laws, codes, and whatever court reports there are. The codes are the most important thing in the civil law system. France has a bunch of codes. There are 75 codes in France, in the French legal system. They're all online. France is a great system. It's called Legifrance. It's wonderful. has everything, all their four courts, everything from their entire courts are all there. Everything is available. Of course, it's in French, but you can work your way through that. This is a listing of all the different codes. They're all online. You click on them, you go to them. If they're English translations, they'll be available as well through this. One thing, just point out that this little section of codes here, there are five codes, Civil Code of Civil Procedure, the Commercial Code, the Criminal Code, and the Code of Criminal Procedure. You will find those in all civil countries there, based on the old code that they own. You will find them everywhere, so just keep an eye on. Those are the major codes that you'll be cited to. Okay. If you go down, look at the Civil Code entry from the Foreign Law Guide. Lists a bunch of secondary sources. They're all in English, which is really nice. Explains the code to you, explains how to find things. It's hard to find. Actually, I have to look on this side over here. Under primary sources, it gives the link directly at Légion France, and it also has a link to the Légion France translations, which is quite useful. France does do some of their, especially code, anything that's used in commerce or taxation would usually get translated. Other stuff, not so much. Family law stuff, some as well. Not all countries are as good at that. Most of the European countries are pretty good. Switzerland is excellent. They do it in three languages, none of which are English. But you can find anything in any of the three languages. So it can be useful. This is where you come to look for it. Okay. Other sources. And by the way, Foreign Law Guide is an expensive product. You come through it through our pay. We pay for it, so you come through it and use it using our subscription. When you're no longer in the university, you'll be paying for your access. There are some other guides out there that are useful. One of them is LLRX. They do comparative law, listing comparative and foreign law. It's a smaller subset of countries. It's not 195, it's only about 50 or so. They're useful, they're pretty good. It's not a bad place to go. It's usually a second or third spot. GlobalX, which is done by the NYU Hauser School of Global Legal Studies, they do actually a pretty good job of both international and foreign law research. These are guides to individual countries. Research guides to the Argentine legal system with an update, for example. If there is an update, use the update. The other one is there just for archival purposes. It will tell you everything that's available online for a particular country. The Library of Congress has a page. Their Guide to Law Online Nations set is a listing of legal materials both. It's both online and in paper. The Law Library of Congress is the world's largest collection of municipal law. In fact, they have better collections than some countries do of their own law. When Haiti had the earthquake, they lost their entire law. Everything. Gone. Destroyed. The Library of Congress had a complete copy. They made a copy for them. So it's actually a very useful resource. It's in town. Most of their stuff is not online. Most of it's in paper. You have to walk, take the metro down to Capitol South and to use it, but it is really, really useful. And if you need to do that, come talk to me and I'll help walk you through it. If you're doing intellectual property research, WIPO, any state that's a member of WIPO, the World Intellectual Property Organization, is required to put their intellectual property laws in English, especially in all world translations. Required to put them in English on their website. It's there, it's available. You can either search by country up here, 42 Algerian laws, for example, are on there. Or you can do it by subcategory. You want to get all the trademark laws in the world, you can do that fairly easily. It also does various treaties, which are quite useful. If you're doing specifically copyright law, UNESCO has a collection of copyright laws in English. Which is useful. Actually, it's in all their official languages, but it's quite useful. It's kept up to date. So if you're in that particular area, I always like to point that one out. Okay, that's foreign law. Really quickly. You're not going to remember anything I said. That's okay. You can come and look at the PowerPoint, which will be up. You can also come talk to me or to Bill Ryan, who's the other foreign international law librarian. He's here early in the mornings, so about 3 o'clock. I'm here in the afternoons, so about 6. So we're here, we're available, we have email, smoke signals, whatever, however you manage to catch us, call us on the phone. when it comes time to sit down and do your research, come talk to us. Especially if it's foreign law, come talk to us. Now let's talk about international law. Three sources of international law: treaties, custom, and general principles of law. The last two, I could sit here and talk for days, and it still would only barely cut the surface. If you need to do research in those two areas, customary law or general principles of law, come and find me. I'll be happy to walk you through it and tell you and tailor what you need to exactly, or tailor what I tell you to exactly what you need. But for treaties, we're going to give you something that will, which is what most people need to find. This will give you stuff that will help you about 75% of the time. The other 25% come talk. Okay. We'll start off with, I'm going to go through a list of sources here, and then I'll show you some screenshot shots. If you're new into international law or into a particular area of international law and you don't understand it, which is most of the time for most people, the Max Planck Encyclopedia of Public International Law is wonderful. 1,600 articles, 1,600 plus articles now, written by experts in the field, very well thought of, explains things really nicely. If you need to find out what a particular ICJ case said, or the International Court of Justice, or the Permanent Court of International Justice said, and you don't want to read those terribly boring, boring cases, they do really nice synopses of cases. Just as a little tip. But it's a wonderful source. Janus, which I'll show you what I mean by Janus, Janus is International Law, and The Nutshell by Bergenthal are both really excellent introductions in international law. Of course, I teach international courts, and I use Janus as my one of my textbooks for people who have never had international law before. It's a really good introduction to international law. The research guides, some of which we already showed you, the NYU ones, we already showed you, the LRX ones. Then there are also some ones from the American Society of International Law that I will show you in just a minute that are also really good. Remember, as Ripple said, use other people's work. Don't reinvent the wheel. The research guides are there. They will lay everything out for you. I also have my own online list that I use for my class. I have a website for my class. It's internationalcourts.net/research. All of the links on it are through our proxy server. They all have the proxy server added to them, so you can click on them from anywhere and it'll take you to the proxy server to get to things. This is what it looks like. Broken down to international law research, foreign law, treaties, non-US treaties, international organizations, and a lot of stuff on international courts, because that's my area. So that's all there. Here's the Max Planck Encyclopedia of Public International Law. It's kind of a confusing page. It's not the easiest thing in the world to navigate. The thing you need to know is up here, which is how you search it. There's also an advanced search button, which I highly recommend. Whenever you're given a choice of a Google box search and an advanced search, use the advanced search. It opens up things, it makes things easier. Because if you get 3,000 results, that's the same as getting no results, because you can't go through the results. You want to be able to narrow it down. And advanced search boxes will do that. Okay, if you scroll down on that page, you see there's 1,600 articles. If you click on that 1,600 articles, you get this. You browse all 1,600 of them, if you want. It's one way of doing it. You can also click on subject and search by subject. And you can search within any results you have. Now, we're going to go to a particular entry. This is General Principles of Law by Gaja. It tells you a couple things that are really useful. It tells you when it was last updated, so you know currency. These are all kept pretty up to date. This is only three years old. Yeah, that's not too bad. It also gives you a list of subjects. And generally, this is sort of an aside here, but whenever you're dealing with a database, follow the in first year legal research they call the one good case method. If you find one good hit on your keyword search in any database, step back. Pull up and see how the people who subject indexed that database, what subject categories they gave it. Now, some databases are not that well subject indexed. Some are really highly detailed. The subject indexing is highly detailed. Like this one is pretty detailed. You can click. Actually, you can't click on this, but you can. This is one that actually you can't click. But you can take these entries and put them in the subject search screen and pull up other things on that subject. Really, really useful. as a way of expanding your research. The other thing that's really good about these wonderful little articles is at the end of each one is a select bibliography of the best works on that particular subject. Not all of them are in English. This is a multinational group. But a lot of them are. And it's, like I said, really useful. It's where I send people first for international law. These are the two books I mentioned earlier. The Nutshell by Bergenthal, which is available as a in your study aid subscription. Was that, it's called West Academic now? Yeah,
yes,
the West Academic, where all the Nutshells and treatises are. You can find it there. Janus is available. We have several copies on reserve. It's a quick read, especially the chapters. I recommend the chapters on custom, treaties, and general principles. Just three chapters. You could read it in an hour, and it's a good introduction. Okay, other resource guides. This is the electronic resource guide. It's a guide to stuff that's available online from the American Society of International Law. These are divided into a bunch of topics. If you're what you're looking for, what you're trying to research is one of these topics, they're really quite useful. And I'm not just saying that because I'm the guy who wrote that one. Doing stuff on the UN, it's a really good resource. I do say so myself. The human rights one is really good. The humanitarian law one is good. The intellectual property law one is really good. The others I haven't used. Well, I have used piracy. But other than that, this is a really good resource. Global Lex, which we looked at for foreign law. This is their international law one. You can see topics on custom, how to search for custom. It's actually pretty good. If you're trying to do legislative history, the legislative history on a treaty, it's actually not called that in the international sphere. They have a really good guide on how you do that. How you look up it. It's called the Trevo Promissoire, the treaty. The different ways to look at it. They can be quite useful. If you're doing that kind of research, come talk to me. Okay. Finding treaties. How much time do I have?
Don't know.
I have plenty of time. Plenty of time. Finding treaties. If it's a U.S. treaty you're looking for, you're in luck. You're in a U.S. law school. We have lots of U.S. resources. It's U.S. domestic law. It's really pretty easy to find. Pine Online is your friend. You can also do it in paper. Everybody has the option to do it in paper. I don't know anybody who does do it in paper, but you could if you wanted to. And we'll show you that treaty thing in a minute. That's in a minute. Most current U.S. treaties and agreements are also available on the official websites of the State Department and the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative. In fact, for some treaties, that is the official site now, is to the website, and we'll show you those in a minute. If it is a treaty that is not yet consented to by the Senate, that's available on congress.gov, and you can track where it is in the process. That can take a long time. We signed the Genocide Treaty in 1948. We wrote the Genocide Treaty primarily. We signed it in 1948. It took until 1984 for the Senate to advise and consent to ratification. It can take a long time. There are a lot of treaties that got bottled up in there. And then they kind of sped their way out for a little bit, and now they're bottled up again. At this point, I think it's probably a good idea to talk about the different types of treaties. In the United States, there are two kinds of international agreements. There are what we call treaties, and there are what we call executive agreements. The outside world, they're all agreements that are signed by the United States, and they have the effect of either treaties or what they call simplified treaties. But inside domestic U.S. law, they're different. A treaty is an agreement signed by the president, submitted to the Senate of the United States for its advice and consent for ratification. The Senate holds hearings, puts together a report, passes a resolution of the Senate with either advising and consenting to ratification or rejecting. Although usually if they reject, it never gets to that stage. It just stays in the Senate until occasionally they'll return one to the president, but it's rare. The president then takes that resolution and the president ratifies the treaty. You see people, there's sort of shorthand, Senate ratifies treaties, the Senate doesn't ratify treaties. The Senate advises and consents to ratification, the President ratifies it. When the President signs the official proclamation and the ratification document, a separate document called the ratification that's signed and sealed with the Great Seal of the United States, and that's sent off to whoever the repository is for the treaty. At that point, he also issues a proclamation, and when that proclamation is signed and sealed, that treaty becomes law in the United States under Article 6. It is at the same level as a statute. So the last in time rule applies. So if it's after a statute, its language would overrule a statute. If a statute is passed after it inside the United States, the statute's language would cover it. Treaties are then also sometimes implemented through other legislation. A lot of treaties have to have that. They want to have effect in the courts. We won't really go into that right now, but just so you know, that's what a treaty is. That's not what most international agreements are. Most international agreements signed by the United States are executive agreements. And of course, it's not just that simple. There are three kinds of executive agreements. There are sole executive agreements, which are done under the power of the president himself. The president is the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. He can sign an armistice agreement on his own power. That binds the United States, but it doesn't go to Congress. Another type of executive agreement are treaty-based executive agreements, where we've signed a treaty, it's been consented for ratification, it's been ratified, so it's an actual treaty, it's law in the United States, but it doesn't cover everything. It leaves a bunch of little things to be negotiated later. Those little things that get negotiated later are executive agreements that the president has authority to do because the Senate consented for ratification. Example would be like the North Atlantic Treaty, which sets up NATO, allows us to put troops in. Other countries can host our troops in Europe. But when we put troops in, say, Germany, put army soldiers in Germany, what happens if one of them does drugs and gets caught by the German police? How do we handle that? Who governs? Does the soldier get turned over to the German police? Does the U.S. military handle it? All of that's negotiated in the status of forces agreement. And the president has the power to do that through the North Atlantic Treaty. Those two are the smallest areas of executive agreements. The large, 85% of executive agreements are what are called congressional executive agreements. Those are agreements that are done with approval of Congress. Congress grants the president the authority to do it through a joint resolution. A joint resolution is a resolution that is passed by both houses and signed by the president. So it meets the presentment clause, so it's in effect a statute. So that's where the power comes to actually sign that treaty or sign that agreement. The biggest example I can think of right now are all the free trade agreements. NAFTA, the CAFTA, the Israeli Free Trade Agreement, the South Korean Free Trade Agreement, all the 23 free trade agreements. None of them are treaties. They're all executive agreements. Congress has given the president the authority to negotiate. The president goes out and negotiates them, brings them back. They pass both the House and the Senate. That's why when NAFTA had to come through, when any of those free trade agreements come through, they don't just go to the Senate, they go to both houses and have to pass both. That's where that power comes from. And you don't look for them in the same place as you do for other troops. We'll get to that in a minute. So after that little aside, which didn't take too long, one other thing is that LexisNexis and Westlaw is the only thing they're good for in foreign and international law research. It's finding the domestic effect of a treaty or an agreement inside the United States, how the US courts have handled it. Westlaw has, you know, the key number system, there's a whole key number for treaties. So you can find out how it's been implemented using standard Westlaw or Lexis, either one will work. Okay, Pine Online. We're talking about the U.S. Treaties and Agreements Library. We're all familiar with, you know, the research up here where you get periodicals of law and all your wonderful law journals. Scroll down to, doesn't show up, shows up over here. U.S. Treaties and Agreements Library. It is your friend. Everything that's involved with the U.S. treaty is there. Everything. Didn't want to go too far. Click on it, and you can get access to treaties in force, which I'll talk about in just a minute. Old copies of the U.S. treaty series, which is the bound volumes that are no longer produced, where treaties were published. Before 1950, treaties were published in the statutes at large. They're all linked here. So if the U.S. is a party to a treaty, it will be in that library, unless it's really, 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 really recent. Another really good source is the United States Department of State's treaty page, which is state.gov/l/s/treaty. It has linked on it, see, treaties in force. Treaties in Force. We'll talk about that first. Treaties in Force is the listing. It's the database. Calling it a database is being too kind. It's the very large, hard-to-use book that tells you whether or not a treaty is in force in the United States. It is woefully out of date. They're in the process of updating it. Come talk to me if you need to find out if a treaty is in force, because it's just too complicated to explain to you how to do it now. It also has listed off, linked off of this page, texts of international agreements to which the U.S. is a party. Slip treaties. These are treaties. Every treaty that we've signed since 1994 is available here. Click on it, go down the list, do it by year. This is not just treaties. This is also executive agreements. So they're all there, or mostly there. Some of them they don't have to publish if they're really not really inconsequential. Click on 2016 treaties and agreements. Here's a listing of them. Click on the very first one, which is the Seychelles Air Transport Agreement. Scintillating reading. Click on that, and this is what they look like. They're PDFs. It's just a slip treaty. It's just the text of the treaty. This is legal evidence. You can use this in court. This is the official version. Okay. Trade agreements are not found. They're the only treaties, executive agreements, that are not found on the State Department's website. They're found on the Office of Trade Rep's website because of the bureaucratic battle between the Office of the Trade Rep and the State Department. So you have to come here and look for them on the side. When you come, you can see them on the side. Free trade agreements are there. Bilateral investment treaties are there. Other investment framework agreements, there are copies of them. They're all available that way. Okay. For treaties that have not yet been consented to, this is where you find. It's congress.gov/treaty. You can, if you know the treaty number, you can put the treaty document number in. Most times you don't. So you can go down and search. It's done by year. You can sort. You can search up here. There's an advanced search screen right here. Really useful. And this will help you track a treaty. If you've been asked to track a treaty through the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, this is how you do it. It's useful and easy to use. Okay, non-U.S. treaties. This is really hard. Much more difficult. If you have a site to the United Nations Treaty Series or the League of Nations Treaty Series, you're in line. If you don't, it's much, much harder. If the treaty is between two foreign countries and neither of them speak English, and especially if they're developing nations, it can be really tough to find. Come talk to me. Or Bill. If you have a UN Treaty Series site, you would think you would go to the United Nations Treaty Series to find the treaty. There's a whole website called the United Nations Treaty Series. It sounds obvious that that's where you go. You don't go there. Because the official UN website, the only thing you can't do there is find a treaty when you know where it is. It's crazy. So instead you go to HIND. The folks at HIND imaged the entire UN Treaty Series and provided us in the United Nations Law. You click on the United Nations Law Collection, you open it up, you click on All Titles. It opens up here. You click on Enter a UN Treaty Series Citation or Enter a League of Nations Treaty Series Citation. It looks like that. You put the volume in, you put the page in, you hit the Get Citation button, and up pops a PDF of the treaty. It's really simple. It's really easy. It's quick. If you have a UNTS site or an LNTS site, that's what you use. If you don't have that, that's what a treaty looks like in HIND. Okay, if you don't have that, there's a couple things you can do. You can go to another American Society of International Law tool called ESOL, which is topically based, and you can look for copies of treaties there. We're going to look for the Convention on, or we're going to look for the Human Rights Convention. So we'll click on Human Rights, and we'll click through. We're looking for the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. Good treaty to look for. If you click on the link right there, it will take you to a copy of the treaty. It's not an official copy of the treaty, but it's a copy you can read the treaty there. The more important thing about this particular website is when you click on the More Information button. When you click on that, you get this. It tells you where it's pulling the link sites from. Because if one's dead, you can go to another one. It gives you information on the treaty, and most importantly, right there, it gives you all the information you need for a Blue Book citation. It's not a Blue Book citation, but all the information you need for a Blue Book. So if you're doing your research and you have the treaty and you didn't get everything down and you're having to do your blue booking at the last minute because that's when everybody is doing their blue booking, You don't want to have to go hunt and find the tree again. You come here, you get the information, you write it in the Google site, and you're done. Don't tell anybody I told you to do that. Okay, UN Treaty Series Collection. This is used to be the worst website in the world, and it is now much better. But as I said, the one thing you can't do here is find the UN Treaty when you know where it is. There are a couple things on it. That's where down, it's too low on here, but over here you might be able to see it. It says UN Treaty Series. You click on that. You could do a full text search of all the treaties in the UN. That can be really, really useful, especially if you're really desperate to find a treaty. Come and talk to me, though, before you do that. The more important thing off this website is this, the status of treaties deposited, multilateral treaties deposited with the Secretary General. Remember I said we sent off a ratification document to wherever the depository was? For 509 of the biggest international treaties, the Secretary General is the depository. And the Secretary General keeps this website, which is divided into a bunch of chapters by topic. For each of the 509 treaties, it gives you some really useful information. The date it was signed, the date it entered into force, its registration number, it means that how many parties it has, how many signatories and how many parties. Here's a link to the complaint. It's the only way you can actually find one of their treaties. Click on it, it takes you to a PDF of the treaty. But more importantly, it lists every party, the date they signed it, the date they either ratified, acceded, or succeeded to it. And most importantly of all, if they had a reservation. We are constantly putting reservations on treaties. They affect how we interpret our obligations. If you want to find out what a country is, if it's one of those 509 treaties, you come here, you find the country that you're looking for, it will give you a copy, an official translation into English of their reservation or declaration. It's the only place that does it, and it's really, really useful. Also, if any of you are doing human rights work with the 9 human rights treaty bodies, the 9 big human rights treaties that are done by the UN, there's a lot of jurisprudence that comes with them, but because the treaty bodies have, well, actually, you know, Claudio does the Convention Against Torture, and they have hearings, they have people bring cases. It's really hard to find those. Bayesky.com, which is done by a law professor in Canada, does a really good job of it. It's a little bit out of date sometimes, but I just want you to realize if you're doing that kind of research, it's a really good tool. And come talk to me and I'll show you how to use it. Okay, that's international foreign law, and I've got 6 minutes. Any questions? Okay. Come find me. Like I said, I know you won't remember you. Come find me. Now I'm going to talk about the two tools. Actually, I'm only really going to talk about Zotero because I don't use them not that much. You'll see why. This is called reference management software. You might not be using this with your faculty member, your professor. Some of them are. I know there are a couple of professors who I've managed to convince to use this. And they will require you to use it. But otherwise, you might, if you do a note for one of the law journals, or if you do your upper level writing requirement, this can really be a useful tool. It's called Zotero. There's also EndNote, which is a for-cost product by Thomson Rust. They help you collect, organize, cite, and share your research sources. There are lots of different competing products. We're going to talk about Zotero and EndNote. Starting with Zotero, it's free open source software. It was created by a grant from the Carnegie Endowment to George Mason University across the river to create it, and they've been keeping it going. It's by scholars, for scholars. It organizes all of your sources, bibliographic information, notes, PDFs, websites, sound files, whatever you want, it puts it together. One-click source collecting, which I'll show you what that means in a minute, automatically senses what type of resource you're storing, grabs database research results from catalogs, Amazon, Google Scholar. It will not import from Lexis, Westlaw, or Bloomberg Law. They do not work and play well with others. In fact, EndNote, which is owned by the people who own Westlaw, does not work with Westlaw Lexis. They're not good at that. They do work with Fastcase, which is one of the other databases you have access to. So if you're doing case law research, I do it in Fastcase because it's much easier to do. It lets you tag your resources and notes. It integrates with Word, LibreOffice, or Google Docs, whether you're doing your writing project, and I'll show you what that means in just a minute. There are 7,000 plus different styles, including the Blue Book, although the official Blue Book citation style that comes with it sucks really badly, because they only got partway through when the Blue Book decided to sue them. I've written my own for the SJD students, and I'll show you how to get access to that. It works much better. It syncs with Zotero.org, so your information is among all your devices. If you have a laptop and a home computer, it will be the same on both. If you don't have your computer with you, but you have, you're in a library and you run across something, you can log on to Zotero and access your research there. You can do it on a tablet, you can do it on your phone. Probably do it on Google Glass if you absolutely need to. It works data on any web browser anywhere. You get 300 megabytes of storage free. More than that, it's $20 a year. You can share your research. Create shared libraries and share it among people. Easy backup of all your work. It's easy to generate a bibliography if you need to do that for a faculty member. There are mobile apps, blah, 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 blah. Okay, there are two versions. If you're going to, I'll just say this right now. If you're going to do this, if you want to use Zotero, come and talk to me and I will walk you through it. There are lots of options. And it would take me an hour to go through them all. So we're just going to say there are two versions. There's a version that lives in, if you use Firefox, it just lives inside Firefox, that was the original. And there's a standalone one that will work with Safari or Chrome. I.e., not so much really. It doesn't work very well. Works on Windows, Mac, and Linux. This is what it looks like when it pops open. Here's your files where you can, you know, organize. You have a bunch of different things here. There's a, for an article on technology in the Wall of War. I've got all my resources. This is where, this is the pane where all the resources are. These are all the tags that you can attach. So if I click on Foreign Relations, it will pull up all the Foreign Relations stuff in one place. I like to break my article. If I'm writing an article, I can say a legal analysis. I'll tag every resource that I want to be a legal analysis. I'm going to use my legal analysis with that tag. So when it comes time to write that section, I click the button, click the tag, and all my resources pop up in one place so I don't miss any. Over here are the various parts. Like here's all the data from the that will go to create the citation. Is over here. You can attach notes. I do all my note-taking in Zotero and attach the notes to each resource. So it's all backed up for me. And like I said, you can tag them. It's really quite useful. I'll give you an example of how it works. Like here, doing a search for a Laura article. Okay, it's my Laura when you do a search in a catalog, and this works for most library catalogs, it works for Amazon and a few other, and LegalTrack and a few other databases. Up here, in your URL field, you get a little book. That indicates that it's saving it. If you click on the little book, it saves it to your Zotero. Click on the little book, it saves it. If you're doing a search in a catalog where it pulls up a bunch of resources, a bunch of answers come back, instead of a book, it's a file folder. You click on the file folder, you get this checkbox list, and you can check the ones you want to add. You hit OK, and it all adds them into your Zotero. And where this is really useful is that there's a plugin for Word. So I'm writing an article here, and this topic, this sentence right here, which are accepted as declaratory of customary international. I realize I need a footnote there. So I click add-ins, a little toolbar, I click add a bibliographic citation. Up pops the Zotero screen. I either type in the last, you know, anything in the citation that I want, or I click on that and I get this field. I get this, which looks just like Zotero. I'm looking for actually the source I want to use is Von Guan. I want to put the thing I'm particularly excited to is on page 9 of Von Guan. I do that, I click OK. This is how you do it. If you don't use that screen, you just type in Von Guan and then put the page in. You'll notice now that there's a footnote. 61. And if you come down here, there it is in almost completely good Blue Book form. And it keeps track of where you are. If you cite to it again, it does a super cite for you. If it moves, it changes what note number. It's really nice. The only thing that is wrong in this is that the University of Minnesota Press pops in, which is not Blue Book style. And that's because in my Zotero database, I had university, that field was full. So I can either go into Zotero and take it out, or I can just delete it here. And so it's not foolproof, it's not complete blue booking, but it's enough. So all you have to do is go through and edit it. Okay. That's Zotero. I also have on my international courts website, there's a Zotero tab. If you click on it, there's a bunch of stuff, a bunch of how-tos, including how to download our Blue Book sign, which is the one I wrote, which is the one you need to use in your documents. Okay, if you're using EndNote, which some people like to use for reasons I can't understand, it's proprietary. It also will not import. It does work well with most other databases. It's very similar in function to Zotero. It has a standalone app for just Word and IE. It doesn't work with any other browser or any other word processor. It works in Windows or Mac. 6,000 plus entries, including the Blue Book. Their Blue Book one is just as bad as the standard one with Zotero. It does have a mobile web app. You can't define your own tags. It's $250, but as long as you're a student at AU, it's free. You can download it. My AU, dunamerican.edu, technology, download software, and there it is. Windows for Mac and for Windows, both 7 and 6, so both versions are available, the older version is available. Which to choose. They're both useful. Zotero is free, open, and your data is in open format. EndNote is free while you're a student, and your data is in a proprietary format. You can really hard to get it out if you have a change. Most folks I know despise EndNote, but your mileage may vary. And that's that. See?
Yay. All right. Thank you all for coming. There should be a sign-up sheet that's going around. Make sure you put your name on it if you're not listed. There are thumb drives in the front with helpful handouts, so pick that up. And thank you very much for coming, and get in touch with us if you need any help at any point in the Dean's Fellow process. Thanks, guys.
Do come and talk to us. Seriously.
It gets lonely.
It's so lonely. I don't know how to turn this on.